take 2 minutes to, there's sort of one central point. So the lecture seven notes are updated. The first paragraph I recommend reading. It summarizes everything you should remember for the rest of your life about the homogeneous puzzles that inflation solves and how it solves them. And so I'm just going to say that in words now. So if there's one thing you should take away or one thing you should understand about the subsequent three puzzles, it's this. So at any given moment in the evolution of the universe, so at any given moment t, there's in general two length scales characterizing the universe at that time. So here I've drawn, just for example, a positive curvature FRW universe. So it expands, the sphere expands out. Okay, so there is the radius of curvature at that moment, A of t. And then there is the Hubble radius, which is H inverse of t. Okay? So one is telling you how big the universe is at that moment. The other is telling you how fast the universe is expanding. But nevertheless, that if you take the inverse of that corresponds to another length scale. Okay, so that's some other length scale. You know, let's say H inverse. The ratio of those two length scales, so this divided by this, is 1 over AH. This thing is called the co-moving Hubble radius. And this is the object to think about. Okay? So the co-moving Hubble radius, this is in co-moving coordinates. So if these are all co-moving observers, so we're thinking in co-moving coordinates. So these various co-moving observers are all just people who sit there at rest on the blackboard. The universe is expanding. The blackboard, really, in physical coordinates, the blackboard would look like all these bits of dust were expanding away from one another. But in co-moving coordinates, they're just sitting there. And around each co-moving observer, there is a co-moving Hubble radius and a corresponding co-moving Hubble sphere that can grow or shrink with time. And all of the puzzles that, all of these three puzzles, the flatness puzzle, the horizon puzzle, and the monopole puzzle, all boil down to the fact that in a universe that is purely decelerating, that has decelerated ever since the Big Bang, that the co-moving Hubble sphere grows with time, okay, to encompass more and more co-moving observers. So point one is that it's always growing with time in a purely decelerating universe, and point two is that. In a purely decelerating universe, like a radiation-dominated universe or a matter-dominated universe, at any given time, the co-moving Hubble radius surrounding a given observer is also the size of his past horizon, roughly speaking. So this thing has a physical meaning in a decelerating universe, which is that this observer at this moment of time, when his co-moving Hubble radius is this size, cannot have received signals since the Big Bang from any observers outside that radius. So all of the puzzles and paradoxes boil down to those two facts. And so the idea of inflation is just to change whatever is necessary to make those two basic facts about the co-moving horizon, that it represents the actual past horizon and that it was always expanding, make those two facts go away. Okay, so inflation is just the idea that prior to radiation domination, after which the universe was decelerating, prior to that, there was a period of inflation where the universe was accelerating. And during the accelerating phase, the co-moving Hubble radius was shrinking. And so in short, the idea of inflation is just that instead of the co-moving Hubble radius always expanding from zero up to larger and larger sizes, In fact, what it did was first it shrank during inflation, and then it grew again after the end, between the end of inflation and today. So it shrank during inflation by some huge factor, e to the minus n, the number of e folds. And again, we're going to find that this n has to be 60 or something like that. So it shrank by some huge factor, and then between the end of inflation and today, it has grown again by some huge factor. But the key point is that the simple geometrical idea is that of inflation is that if the amount that it shrank during inflation was greater, if the factor by which it shrank during inflation was greater than the factor by which it has regrown since inflation, all three puzzles are solved. Okay? So in other words, here is the, let's say this is the, let's say this is the co-moving Hubble sphere at the beginning of inflation, and then by the end of inflation it's some tiny thing, and then since the end of inflation it's re-expanded out to this size. All three puzzles will be solved as long as the present day co-moving Hubble sphere is still contained within the Hubble sphere prior to inflation. Okay? So this afternoon's tutorial will be about estimating. One of the things you'll do will just go through the. I'm not going to go through the monopole problem in class, but you'll just estimate that. You'll see why if the universe was radiation dominated all the way back to the beginning, then at the grand unified phase transition, you would produce far too many monopoles. You would produce so many monopoles that the universe would be. That the monopoles today would account for absurdly more than the critical density. And so, if this condition holds, then you're guaranteed that the number of. So if instead the gut phase transition happens, and then a period of inflation happens which satisfies this condition, you are guaranteed to have less than one monopole in the whole observable part of your universe today. Less than one monopole per current co-moving Hubble volume. That's the main takeaway point. If you don't see why the three puzzles are all resolved by that basic geometrical requirement, then that's the thing you should aim to understand about the basic puzzles that led to inflation. That's sort of the key. That's the key idea expressed in the best way. Okay. But with that said, I'm now going to move on to. So this is now pure. This has been so far pure geometry, you might say. It's just about. We've just argued that all these three puzzles can be explained by a geometrical fact that the universe underwent a period, an early epoch with. A double dot greater than zero, accelerated expansion. But so now we just want to turn to the simplest, you might say, leading candidate for what physically caused that acceleration and what predictions does it make, in brief. Okay? And so, in short, I'm going to start by working in general with, we said the action in general for general relativity is there's the gravitational term, the term that involves only the metric, g mu nu, the Ricci scalar minus 2 lambda over 16 pi g Newton. And then, in general, there can be more terms that depend on matter fields. And so, In single field slow roll inflation, the only matter field that is relevant in the universe is just a single scalar field. So a single scalar field has an action given by this. Okay, and in fact, what we will see is that the data are perfectly explained currently by the simplest. Potential you could think of, which is v of phi equals 1/2 m squared phi squared. So a free massive scalar field, a single free massive scalar field. So this theory has only one free parameter in it. So we will end up having to set this parameter to match observations. We'll end up having to tune this parameter to 10 to the 13 GeV. But that's it. And so with just one free parameter and this very simple shape for the potential, you get a lot. You get a lot of things about the universe are explained, and a lot of predictions are made that are so far in agreement with very stringent observations. Okay, so we don't know that this model is right by any stretch of the imagination. It's really a very wide open question: what physically caused inflation? But the basic point that I want to get across is that this is the sort of gold standard in terms of economy and predictivity, just in terms of compactness of explanation. This is the gold standard against which any other model that you hear about for the early universe has to be compared. Okay, because this model is like really stunningly successful at the moment. Okay, let me first explain why in general this framework and this framework, first of all, does at the homogeneous level what you want. In other words, it first generates a period where A double dot is greater than zero, and then generates a period where A double dot is less than zero. So it by itself generates inflation, and then it transitions to a transitions to a decelerating epoch, which is the first thing you want. Okay, so the way we will argue that. So again, so first I'm going to say a few things about the homogeneous behavior of this picture, and then we will discuss in the end of this lecture and the beginning of the next one, and the next one, the inhomogeneous behavior. So the homogeneous behavior. So we saw this in the previous lecture and in the tutorial when we were discussing the non-thermal relic. That if you calculate the stress energy tensor for the scalar field and you compare its stress energy tensor to what the stress energy tensor was supposed to be when you derived the Friedman equation and the continuity equation, you took a stress energy tensor that was like diagonal minus rho plus p plus p plus p. So you compare those two things and you find that for a homogeneous scalar field, its energy density is 1/2 phi dot squared plus v of phi. So it's basically kinetic energy plus potential energy. And its pressure is 1/2 phi dot squared minus v of phi. And then we had also derived, so the conservation of stress energy here, so T mu nu, the divergence, stress energy, conservation of stress energy, the fact that energy momentum are not locally created or destroyed. They just flow around from one infinitesimal volume to another. That's expressed in this statement. The nu equals I component is trivially 0 equals 0 for an FRW universe, but the nu equals 0 component is not trivial. It's the continuity equation, which I have grown to love. I can only hope that you will grow to love the continuity equation as much as I do. So if you plug these expressions for rho and p into this expression, then you get the homogeneous equation of motion for a scalar field. Okay. And so now I want to... So far, I haven't said anything about what V of phi is. I've said that eventually, this particular case of V of phi will work beautifully. But since we don't know this is right, let's begin by talking a bit more generally about V of phi. So what I'm going to imagine is V of phi can be any old thing, but it has to have the property that I'm going to assume that it has the property that one of its minima could be one of the local, not necessarily the global minimum, but one of its minima so it is located at v equals zero. Okay, So in other words, there's no gap between the minimum and zero potential energy. And that as you imagine displacing the field away from its minimum, that when you get far enough away from the minimum, you get into a regime which we'll call the slow roll regime, in which the two slow roll parameters, which I will define to be epsilon and eta, okay. So in other words, epsilon and eta, these are two functions that depend on phi. You give me the potential, you give me the functional form of the potential, v of phi, and I take dv d phi divided by v of phi, square that, multiply by a constant, and that gives me the new function, epsilon of phi. Okay. And similarly, if I take the second derivative of v and divide it by v, I get the function eta of phi. These are called the slow roll parameters. And they're very useful quantities to have just defined at the start. They'll be useful in a number of places in following analysis. But so in particular, I will just assume that as I get far enough away from the potential here, I will assume, because observations have now driven us with it in this type of model, in this sort of single field model, have driven us now to this is the only assumption in this context that is consistent with the data. I will assume that as you go far enough from the minimum here, that you get into a slow roll regime where the potential gets sufficiently where eta is much less than 1 and epsilon is much less than 1.
Question?
Yeah.
Why do we require that v has to be 0 at 1 at its minimum?
Because otherwise, so what we want, one way to say it is that if the field got trapped in some, so the height of this potential, the height from which the field has to drop, will turn out to be very large in fundamental units. It might be 10 to the 16 GeV to the fourth power or something like that. So if there was a gap between the bottom of the potential and zero, then at the end of inflation, a homogeneous part of the scalar field would get trapped in that. And so that would act like a huge positive cosmological constant in conflict with observation. That's one thing. But a very closely related point is that what I'm about to explain is that if the potential has these features, that it obeys the slow roll conditions when the field is displaced from the origin, and then the field can monotonically evolve, roll, as the lingo goes, down to its minimum at v equals zero. Then, as it gets close to its minimum at v equals zero, the slow roll conditions automatically become violated, and the universe automatically transitions from accelerating to decelerating. Whereas if this minimum was non-zero, then what would happen is that again, because the field would go down to its minimum and act like a positive cosmological constant, a positive cosmological constant causes the universe to accelerate. So the universe would not transition out of acceleration into a decelerating phase. It would get stuck in an accelerating phase, which is another reason, which is one of the, when I say that that's in conflict, that a large positive cosmological constant is in conflict with observations, that's part of what I mean. So in other words, observationally, if the gap is non-zero here, the non-zero value is tiny. It's equal to today's apparently observed cosmological constant. But that's essentially zero, because it's so that gap is so many orders of magnitude smaller than this height from which inflation will have to roll down, that it's, to a good approximation, it's zero. Okay, so yeah, so like I was just saying, what I want to show is that, so like when we discussed this equation before, this equation of motion for the scalar field, we said this is like the equation of motion for a particle. This is like Newton's law, the acceleration mx double dot is equal to minus some potential v prime of x, and then a particle acted on by a force, a potential force, which is minus the derivative of some potential, and then frictional force, some coefficient times x dot. Okay, so if I just bring these terms over to the right-hand side of the equation and divide by m, of course, or set m to 1, you know, that this is like the equation of motion for a particle with acceleration phi double dot being acted on by a friction term where the frictional coefficient is 3h, and then a potential term. So there are these two competing forces. And you can either be in the regime, just like with a harmonic oscillator, you can either be in the regime where the dynamics is potential dominated, where the frictional force is just a small perturbation. So the field is moving through its potential. It's essentially dominated by the force coming from the potential, but with a mild frictional force sucking energy out of it. So that's what the behavior will be like close enough to the minimum. But on the other hand, far enough from the minimum, the frictional force will dominate. And so what will happen instead? Well, you know what happens when a particle is dominated by friction. It, you know, if you drop a coin from a building. Last time I said if you jump from a building, but I'm a wiser, you know, you grow, and if you drop a feather from a building, then what it does is, okay, initially it is it may be potential dominated. It may be dominated by the gravitational force pulling it down, but it quickly achieves its terminal velocity, where its acceleration becomes negligible, and these two terms perfectly balance against one another. And so in that regime where these two terms are balancing against each other to solve this equation with negligible contribution from this guy, you can solve and find that let me see. So what I want to say is that if you're up here in the region where the slow roll regime is satisfied, that amounts to saying that you're in this regime where you quickly relax to your terminal velocity. You're in a friction dominated regime, and you can see that by thinking about either of the slow roll parameters. So you can either say, okay, let me compare the size of this term to this term. So basically h let me imagine, so unlike a normal damped harmonic oscillator where it's in a potential with a constant frequency that's a constant and a damping term that's a constant. Here this potential is not purely quadratic, so the frequency here it's not a pure harmonic oscillator, it doesn't have a constant frequency. And the damping term, H, can depend on time, so it's not a constant damping. So the whole idea is that whether the field is overdamped or underdamped will change with time and with where it is on the potential. So what we want to do is we want some local characterization of whether it is currently at this given moment and at this given position on the potential, overdamped or underdamped. So let's do that by expanding this thing locally. So around the position where we are at the moment, we'll write V prime of phi is a constant plus V double prime of phi naught. Times phi minus phi naught. And so you can ask, on the one hand, so basically what you can show is that regardless of which of these two terms is the more important one, that either way, one or the other of these conditions tells you that you are in the regime analogous to the damped harmonic oscillator. Where, so for example, let's imagine this term is negligible relative to this term. So locally what's happening is that the potential is feels like it's at the moment in a harmonic oscillator where this is the omega squared of the harmonic oscillator. This is the constant times a linear displacement that is the force coming from the harmonic oscillator. So, but in our previous encounter with the harmonic oscillator, when we had actually taken V to be the actual harmonic oscillator potential, so we had phi double dot plus 3H phi dot plus M squared phi is equal to 0. There we had said the distinction between overdamped and underdamped was whether it was overdamped it was friction dominated when m squared was small relative to when relative to h squared, and when m was small relative to h. So in this case, the analog of m squared is the local second derivative of the potential. So we would look at the analog of m squared over h squared, but that's v double prime over h squared, but h squared is at least v, because in other words, h squared goes like 8 pi g over 3 rho, and rho, we said, is 1/2 phi dot squared plus v of phi. And so h is at least as big as if I just neglected the phi dot squared term here. But this thing we already know. So g is 1 over m Planck squared. So this would really be So this is an underestimate for how overdamped the system is, but this thing is precisely what we set to be much less than 1 when we set eta much less than 1. Okay? So one of the things that I'll ask you to do in the problem set is just to go back and convince yourself that this is right, that when you're far from the potential, these conditions amount to saying that you're in the regime where you quickly relax to your terminal velocity, which is this thing. And that furthermore, once you've relaxed to your terminal velocity, and again, you're still assuming these conditions hold, that is the regime in which this equation, together with these equations, implies that phi dot squared is much less than v. So in this Friedman equation, in this regime, I can drop this phi dot squared relative to v. So I can, in other words, I can in that regime take h squared to be approximately 8 pi g over 3 times whatever v is at that moment. So So I get these two useful relations that at any given moment I can determine how slowly the field phi is oozing down the potential by just simply looking at the slope of the potential divided by the Hubble constant at that moment. And I can figure out how fast the universe is expanding in a given moment by simply looking at the height of the potential at that moment. And then the final point is that when phi dot squared is much less than v, that directly implies from these equations that directly means that w, the ratio of p divided by rho, is less than minus 1/3. But from our previous analysis, we have seen, earlier in the notes, we saw that we learned that w less than minus 1/3 implies acceleration. Okay. So, just to summarize, so these things are all things that I just want to get across the basic point, and then these are things that are going to be checked on the problem set. So basic point number one is when I start with the field displaced up into the slow roll regime where these conditions are satisfied, that gives me two useful approximations. One approximation that tells me how fast the field is, or how slowly the field is oozing down the potential. The second approximation tells me how fast the universe is expanding. It's just given by the value of the potential at that moment. And finally, that during that regime, the universe is accelerating, which is the first thing we wanted. And then, eventually, as the field rolls close enough to its minimum, the minimum becomes well described by the terms up to quadratic order in its Taylor expansion. So up to quadratic order in its Taylor expansion, once the field finally gets far enough down, its potential is just, well, we said its zeroth order term in its Taylor expansion vanishes by assumption, because the potential vanishes here. The first order term vanishes at a minimum, v prime vanishes. So the second order term is some term like this. And when we get close enough to the minimum, we can neglect the higher order terms. But we've already treated this guy. When we treated the axion, what we saw was that when this guy gets close enough to its minimum, m squared becomes big relative to h squared, and in that regime, the friction term just becomes a small effect. The system becomes underdamped, and it transitions to, so in the regime, in this regime, when you get close enough to the minimum, phi goes like a to the minus 3/2 cosine mt. So when it gets close enough to the minimum, it oscillates about the minimum like cosine mt. And due to this a to the minus 3/2 factor, the oscillations gradually die away. The amplitude of the oscillation decreases with time. The field settles into the minimum of its potential. And the main point for us at the moment is simply that if you use this expression for phi to calculate rho, so you calculate 1/2 phi dot squared, where phi is given by this, plus v of phi, where v is given by this quadratic approximation to the minimum, you find that rho is proportional to a to the minus 3. In other words, this is how non-relativistic matter behaves. Its energy density decays as a to the minus 3. So this is now a decelerating universe. Okay? So that's the first thing. At the homogeneous level, this summarizes what the model accomplishes. So in other words, this summarizes, in general, what a model of this form, where the slow roll conditions are satisfied far from the minimum, so the field slowly, If the slow roll conditions are satisfied far from the minimum, the field slowly oozes down. And during this slow oozing phase, the universe is automatically accelerating. And then when it gets close enough to the minimum, the slow oozing phase gives way to underdamped oscillations that die away. During that phase, the universe automatically is decelerating. And again, I will not go into detail on this point, but this oscillating field decaying as rho proportional to a to the minus 3. It's decaying like a gas of non-relativistic particles, but it really is a gas of non-relativistic particles. They have a very non-thermal distribution, but it's a bath of particles of mass m. And so the final step that you need, which is not included in this model, is that you need those particles of mass m to have some coupling, have some terms in the Lagrangian that couple them to other fields, ultimately that couple them to the fields of the standard model, so that those particles can eventually decay into the radiation, the standard model radiation bath of standard model particles that we know was filling the universe by the time the energy got down to Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So that, okay? Clear? Has everybody heard that story before? Am I telling that to? Is that no? That's good. Okay, great. I was a little worried that I just spent a bunch of time telling people what they've already learned somewhere else. But okay, great. So that's step one. And in particular, at this level, the first thing to notice is that our gold standard model has these properties. That if you look, the final thing to say about the homogeneous case is that you will check on the homework that the simple fact that for the potential V equals 1/2 m squared phi squared, that when the field is displaced from its minimum by a distance, so if this displacement phi is greater than M Planck, then the slow roll conditions are satisfied. So epsilon is much less than 1, eta is much less than 1. And then when phi is much less than M Planck, epsilon and eta are much greater than 1. And so slow roll ceases, and as we said, the universe transitions to a decelerated phase. Okay? Okay, so with that, I will now just proceed to discuss the perturbations. Does anyone, it doesn't look like anyone, can I erase the whole board, or anyone object? No. Oh, it's terrible, but I forgot to prepare a joke for today. I'm not sure I can remember. I think I may have run dry on the ones that I can just remember off the top of my head. Does anyone else have a joke for this moment? Anyone else have a joke? Anybody? I would appreciate it. It doesn't even have to be Russian. It just has to cheer up the class. I'm just trying to put off the point where you rebel and come and, Okay. Don't rebel. If you're unhappy, it's... Okay, go.
A musician is
reading some music by Bach.
Is this joke going to be appropriate? Yeah. I've tried to keep these jokes, you know, more or less.
So a musician is reading some music by Bach in a train when the KGB arrests him. And they're grilling him about what these, you know, these notations sort of mean. And he says, well, no, this is my Bach, you know. And, you know, they are not buying the story. So after a few days, you know, they come back, bring him to the questioning chamber and say, well, last night Bach confessed. Now it's your turn.
Good. Oh man, I should have started much earlier having other people tell the jokes. Okay. So perturbations. So we want to perturb. We have in our simple model. You know, in single field inflation, the idea is that the energy density of just this one real scalar field, this one extra degree of freedom, dominates the universe so much that we can neglect everything else, at least during inflation. So we just have our metric and our scalar field. And so far, throughout this whole course, I'm embarrassed to say, we have always assumed that these things, in all of the calculations that we've been doing, we've been assuming perfect homogeneity, right? We've been assuming that nothing varies from point to point in space, things only vary in time. And that was an exceptionally good approximation in the early universe, which everyone knows is the coolest part of the universe anyway. But when you tell it to people outside of this course that you never heard anything about the fact that there were inhomogeneities in the universe, they may say, with some justification, that seems to miss out on some of the observed features of the universe, like you and me and other, you know, I mean, you know what I'm saying. So I do just want to briefly say the early universe cosmologist's perspective on inhomogeneities, and that is that they are small. Okay, so in the early universe, they're very small. So we have some homogeneous part of the metric, which I will write as g mu nu half, which just depends on t. And then there's some small perturbation, delta g mu nu, which depends on both t and x. And similarly, for the field phi, it has a homogeneous part, phi hat, which only depends on t, and a perturbation, which depends on both t and x. And in the early universe, these perturbations were small in the sense that typically the components of the perturbations are about 10 to the minus 5. One part in 100,000 of the homogeneous parts. So they're very small, and so you can treat them. You can every time a perturbation appears, you can do a good approximation, linearize the equation that it appears in. You can just Taylor expand it to linear order in the perturbation because the perturbation is so small that the second order correction is very small. If you just want to know the So we've measured the properties of these very well in the early universe through observations of the cosmic microwave background. And so the idea of inflation is to give the final thing I'm going to explain about inflation is give a sense of how it attempts to explain where these 10 to the minus 5 perturbations in the early universe came from. Okay, then as the universe evolved, after the end of inflation, you went through the radiation-dominated era, these 10 to the minus 5 perturbations began to grow a little bit. Let's say maybe some of them got to be 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3, they were still small. But then during the matter-dominated era, they really began to go nuts. And so in particular, the shorter modes began to grow fast first, and then longer and longer modes began to grow. So that today, sufficiently short modes, their perturbations have grown so that they're equal to or larger than order one of the background perturbation. Well, the scalar field phi is no longer around, but let's talk about the perturbations in the metric, or more importantly, the perturbations in the what I really mean to be referring to is, if you look at the density, the energy density, from one point in space to another. It has a homogeneous part and an inhomogeneous part. And today, that inhomogeneous part, if you Fourier decompose this and look at sufficiently long wavelength Fourier components, those are still 10 to the minus 5. They still have their primordial value. But as you go to shorter and shorter wavelengths, they have had a chance to grow more and more. And so at short wavelengths, below, let's say, scales of 10 megaparsecs, 30 light years or something like that, they've grown so much that they can, that they're no longer perturbations, that they're of the same order as the background energy density. And so those are the scales in which you begin to see fully collapsed objects, like below, and scales shorter than that, you begin to see first clusters of galaxies, and then galaxies, and then, you know, globular clusters, stars, you and me. We didn't actually gravitationally collapse, you and me, but okay, so the first point I want to make about these guys is that that this splitting of these fields into background part and perturbation is not unique. It is redundant, or there's gauge redundancy, because just like in a general relativity course, you will learn, or you have learned, or you will learn, that if you just take pure gravity, gravity with no other fields, you forget about other fields, and you just want to look at how the perturbations about flat space behave. So you write the metric as the flat Minkowski metric plus a perturbation h mu nu. This perturbation depends on space and time. Let's just refer to the four-dimensional coordinate here, because we're just in Minkowski space. So it looks like it's a 4x4 symmetric matrix, so that has 10 components, but it does not represent 10 physical degrees of freedom. It only represents 2 physical degrees of freedom, the 2 polarizations of a gravitational wave. So how do we get from 10 to 2? The answer is we do it by subtracting 4 and then subtracting 4 again. So in other words, of the original 10 components of this matrix or matrix of fields, 4 of them get killed by the Bianchi identities. So the Bianchi identities, that's this fact that regardless of the Einstein equations, just for any geometry, for any Riemannian geometry, in differential geometry, just forget about the Einstein equations. Nothing to do with what matter or what the theory of space-time is. If you add up the 3 terms where you cyclically permute gamma, delta, and epsilon here, so delta, epsilon, comma, gamma, plus r alpha, beta, epsilon, gamma, comma, delta, those vanish. So that leads to the fact that these four components of the Einstein equations, the Einstein tensor is divergenceless, and it satisfies this equation not because of the Einstein equations, but simply as a contraction of this Bianchi identity. So this equation has 4 components. Those 4 components end up removing as independent degrees of freedom 4 of the components of this matrix. And then 4 more are killed by gauge freedom, where in general relativity, what we mean by gauge freedom is the freedom to make coordinate transformations. So if I make an infinitesimal coordinate transformation, x mu goes to x mu plus some infinitesimal change, zeta mu or psi mu, which can depend on space. So some space dependent, some space time dependent infinitesimal coordinate transformation then, well, since you know how GMU knew how the components of it change under a coordinate transformation. So if you work out what the effect of this coordinate transformation is on H, it changes one infinitesimal perturbation, H mu nu, to a new one, which is just given by, which changes by the by an amount set by the size of your coordinate transformation. So this is just saying that you can have two different perturbations H mu nu, two things that look at first glance like different perturbations of Minkowski space, but really they're just the same perturbation expressed in different coordinates. Okay? So that's what, and so since there's 4 degrees of coordinate transformations, you have four functions here that you can, that you're free to choose. You're free to transform four coordinates that have four functional degrees of freedom that you can transform them by. That eats up another 4 components here, and you're left with only 2 degrees of freedom. So now in the FRW metric, the same thing is true. If I start with a universe that is almost homogeneous but plus a small perturbation, then I can make an arbitrary infinitesimal coordinate transformation, and I will still look like I'm in a universe that is nearly the Friedman universe plus an infinitesimal transformation, and I still have these 4 constraints. So in the FRW case, without going into detail, I will just say that the only difference between the FRW case and this case that I just described is that we have this one additional degree of freedom. So instead of naively 10 degrees of freedom, we have 10 plus 1 equals 11 degrees of freedom. But again, 4 of them get eaten by constraints. 4 of them get eaten by gauge freedom. And so at the end of the day, we should expect to have only 3 degrees of freedom. And we can choose a gauge in which those 3 degrees of freedom take the most convenient form. Okay, and so for single field inflation, the gauge to choose, and so here I'm not going to spend too much time explaining this in more detail. This is actually a great thing to think about if you're going to do cosmology more, but for our purposes, this is one of the, in general I've tried to derive things from first principles and more or less explain things so that they're understandable. This is probably going to seem like a bit of a gloss, and that's okay. There's going to be another gloss in the next lecture, but I've tried to keep that to a minimum. So we're going to choose the gauge where delta phi is equal 0. So in other words, you can make a coordinate transformation, a little infinitesimal coordinate transformation that removes whatever perturbations were present in the scalar field. So we're going to use coordinates where the scalar field looks perfectly homogeneous. And that's not going to use up all of our coordinate transformation. We're going to use the extra coordinate transformation to write the metric as follows. First, it is convenient to think of the metric in the so-called ADM, or 3 plus 1 decomposition. Now, I think I came into class and saw on the board that Renato Wall had introduced this. I know some of you aren't taking her course, but it's not crucial. There's one little intermediate thing here where I have to gloss over some stuff, I'll just tell you where to learn about this stuff if you're interested. So you can write the metric. These guys, ADM. Those are the names of 3 people who in the 60s realized that a very good idea, if you want to split space-time nicely into space and time, a very good way to do it is to rewrite the metric in the so-called ADM form, which is like this, and so this function n is called the lapse function, this function ni is called the shift vector, and hij, so you've sliced your space-time into slices of space, and time running this way. Hij is the 3 metric on this slice of space. So you have some, at a given time t, you have some slice, and if you just confined all of your, you can find yourself to only live on that slice, the metric on that slice, the induced metric on that slice would be this hij. So the reason to do this is that, one of the reasons that this formalism is nice is that you can take hij as the degrees of freedom to be specified, this 3x3 spatial field matrix, and then the constraint equations, the Bianchi identities or the constraint equations, end up determining n and ni. So n and ni are precise. We said that the constraints get rid of 4 degrees of freedom. So 4 of the degrees of freedom appearing in G in the 4x4 matrix G mu nu are not really independent degrees of freedom. They're completely determined by the constraints. Though in writing it this way, those things just explicitly appear. They're this function n, those 4 things that are removed, and this vector ni, where I runs from 1, 2, 3. And then hij, we had these 4 degrees of gauge freedom by changing coordinates. We've already used up 1 degree of gauge freedom to set delta phi as equal to 0. We use the remaining 3 to write the spatial metric in the form a squared of t e to the rho of e to the 2 rho t comma x e to the 2 hi, oh, let me call, sorry, let me call hij gamma ij, sorry. I want to use hij for something else. So the spatial metric in the ADM decomposition is gamma ij, and I want to write that as a squared, which is just the scale, the ordinary FRW scale factor, so that's independent of space, times 2 factors that are dependent on space, and then I use my if this is a matrix, try to make the indices less confusing here. Okay, what we're doing is we're writing this 3x3 matrix gamma as a number, or a number that is purely a function of time, not a matrix, a squared of t, the ordinary scale factor, and then times another number, not a matrix, but this number can depend on both space and time. So this is another way to say this is these 2 things combined are like saying that now we let the scale factor not just depend on space, but it can depend on space and time a little bit. I mean, it can not just on time. We can let the scale factor not just depend on time, but this is like the effective scale factor. But it now has a little bit of space dependence as well. This rho is a small number, so this is just a little modification to the scale factor. And then H is a matrix, which we can use our gauge freedom to choose that the trace of that matrix is 0 and that the divergence of that matrix is 0. So in other words, delta ij partial sub I hjk is equal to 0. And so physically rho, like I say, rho is this rescaling, this space-dependent rescaling of the scale factor. So this is the part of the perturbation that you will hear people describe as the primordial scalar perturbation or the primordial curvature perturbation. The bottom line is this is the thing we have observed. This is the thing that ultimately, this is the perturbation that leads to everything else, that leads to the growth of density perturbations as the universe evolves, galaxies, you and me. This part is, this is the H, the little perturbation H, is the primordial vector, is the primordial tensor perturbation. That's how you'll sometimes hear it described. This is really just, this is again, these are gravitational waves. These there's, when you take a 3x3 matrix and you demand that it be traceless and that it be transverse, that leaves 2 degrees of freedom. Those 2 degrees of freedom are the two polarizations of the gravitational wave, the same two polarizations that you found, that in just slightly different language, that the H that you find in a GR course for gravitational waves with two polarizations, those are the same two polarizations that are left over in this matrix H. And so we're almost to the end of the glossing period where I can get back to actually doing calculations that you understand, but as far as I could tell, there was no way around this little. Do any of the other lecturers gloss? Glossing is inevitable. It's like a 3-week course. You got to do a little bit of gloss. You have to forgive me for this glossing. If you're the sort of person who gets mad at glossers, you just shouldn't. I tried to not gloss, but it's impossible. So, which is not to say that this is hard to understand or anything. It's just probably at the speed that I'm doing it, it's not going in very well. So I'm just trying to make sure you've seen it, even if you don't fully absorb what I'm saying. But really, this is all actually straightforward stuff that you totally could would not. It's not like you need to some course on something before you understand what I'm saying here. In case that's the impression that I'm giving, it's just that I don't have time to explain this properly. But the main point that I want to get to, I want to get across the idea that once we've used up all of our gauge freedom and imposed the constraints, we have these 1 plus 1 scalar and 2 tensor degrees of freedom. So 1 density perturbation and 1 scalar perturbation. Now inflation is going to produce by a quantum mechanics in an expanding space-time, we're going to calculate the fluctuations induced in this guy and the fluctuations induced in this guy. The calculation is, I'm really just going to do it for this guy, and then in the notes I show that it's exactly parallel for this guy. So once you know how to do this guy, you know how to do this guy. The starting point for that, the starting point for the next lecture is just the following. If we take the action that we started with, the action that is supposed to be describing single field inflation, so which I erased, so I'll write it again. So it's the action that we met in the first or second lecture. Plus the matter action for a single scalar field. Sorry, I'm two minutes from ending. Sorry for running over. Okay, and we're assuming that lambda is equal to zero in single field inflation. That's another way to say that it's equivalent to the assumption that the minimum of V is at zero. So this action, the Ricci scalar minus the kinetic term minus the potential term, if you plug in this perturbed metric, and the scalar field again is unperturbed, we took a gauge choice where it's unperturbed. Now you can expand this expression in powers of the perturbations, of these perturbations rho and h. So at zeroth order, you get some expression, but it's not relevant for us in discussing the term that's zeroth order in the perturbations is the term that if you calculate the variation of that term, that gives you the Friedman equation, the continuity equation, the homogeneous. It gives you all the homogeneous equations of motion. So we've already derived those. So throw that part away. Now, if you expand this up to first order, it will automatically vanish. Because remember, that is the condition for the zeroth order homogeneous equations to have been the classical solution. The way we derive the classical equations of motion is by demanding that the first order perturbation of the action around those equations of motion vanishes. Okay? So the first order bit will vanish. So the first non-trivial bit, the first non-trivial bit in this expansion is the part that is quadratic in the perturbations. And if you expand, you can see in principle it's a straightforward thing to do. You take the expressions that we've derived, plug it in, just expand this thing to up to quadratic order. Taylor expand this expression up to quadratic order. In principle, it's straightforward. In practice, if you don't know how to do it the right way, the algebra becomes a mess. If you want to see how to do it the right way, where it's not a mess, there is a very nice paper by Juan Maldacena from 2002. I give the reference in my notes. It's archive AstroPH. Anyway, section 2 of that paper is where he shows how to derive the leading part of the action, the quadratic part of the action. Then there are higher order terms in the action, but you can show that those, for single field inflation, are negligibly small. You'll probably never be able to, they're so small you'll probably never be able to observe them. So to an excellent approximation, all we need is the quadratic part of the action. And so that's this expression that is currently, the quadratic part of the action has two parts. I meant to call this thing zeta, not rho. How long have I been confusing that? I guess I only began talking about it here. Okay, so what I meant to call this thing was zeta. Sorry about that. I'm constantly mixing up rho and zeta. So there's an action for zeta, which is given by equation 6. It's a very simple expression at the end of the day, given by equation 16a in my notes. And then there's an action for h, which is given by equations 16b and c. So I'll explain that these are, in the next lecture, I'll explain that these are actually actions that you are very familiar with. They're simpler than the actions that you dealt with in your quantum field theory class. They are just the action for a free massless scalar field. And so we'll just see how if you repeated the stuff that you did in the first couple lectures of a quantum field theory class, but for these very simple actions, how you get out the predicted two-point correlator of these fields in an expanding, in an inflationary universe. And now that's the thing that you observe in the CMB. So anyway, that'll be the next lecture.